Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to Don't Leave It All to the Men, a series of stories from women in Waitaha, Canterbury, about their experiences in local body government. The stories were recorded by the National Council of Women, Otatahi Christchurch branch. Our first guest is Vicky Southworth. Vicky was elected as a councillor to Environment Canterbury in 2019 and re-elected for a second term in 2022.
So we're just going to have a few questions about your experience working as an Air Canning councillor. Can you tell me a bit about your life at the moment in Jingle? How are things going for you at the moment?
Yeah, pretty good. We're coming to the end of the term, so starting to think about standing for election again. So there's sort of like doing the job and also starting to plan ahead for the election campaign. That's part of a councillor's cycle, is that. A lot of people asking about whether I'm standing again and all those sort of, you know, that decision moment.
And what about, we just wanted to talk about your story being in local government. So we're really interested to know what made you decide to stand for a role on Environment Canterbury.
So I have done a Master's of Water Resource Management at University of Canterbury. I'm a geologist originally from the UK, and I worked in planning and also in geology and groundwater and things like that. So then when I took the master's here in water resource management, recognising there's a few issues around water in the Canterbury region, I ended up being selected to be on something called the Regional Committee, which was part of the Canterbury Water Management Strategies, connecting into community members. And off the back of that, I started to sort of just rub shoulders with some of the local politicians. And so I got shoulder tapped by Sarah Templeton, asked if I'd consider standing for election, at which point I was like, I don't think so. And then I had a couple of other people ask me the same quite independently. And I thought, in the end, I thought, well, maybe I could. And then the thing that really sort of sealed it for me was that, as you start to sort of rub shoulders, you've got your ear to the ground, everyone's figuring out who might be putting their hand up for going onto the ballot paper. And I didn't hear any women's names at all. There was only men. And I'd not long before written an article for International Women's Day that I put on my LinkedIn page about sort of trying to juggle study and work and children, talking about the things that in society making it difficult for women to sort of pursue a career. And having more women in leadership was one of the key things that I felt might help. And so I thought, well, if there's no one on the ballot paper to vote for who's female, then you can't really complain. And I put my name forward, and there were five men and me that stood for the South Canterbury constituency for Environment Canterbury. So I was pleased I did put my name. And I got elected.
So that was for the South Canterbury what?
South Christchurch.
South
Canterbury.
So South Christchurch.
Yeah, South Christchurch constituency. Yeah.
How many were able to be elected?
Two. So there were two positions, six candidates. Yeah. And the other candidate who came through was Phil Clearwater, who had been in council for a long time at Christchurch City Council. So, he was well known, and the rest of us, I think, were all pretty unknown. So it was quite an unusual year that year, and that it was the first year of going back to full regional council elected members after having had commissioners in. Mm-hmm. So the year before I got elected, or the 3 years before I got elected, was a mixed model with part commissioners, part elected. And this was the first fully elected council coming in. So it was quite an open field, because often you'll see if a candidate stands again who's been in the council already, that bit of name recognition is quite helpful, and it's quite common to, it's more difficult to knock somebody out once they've been in council for a bit. Not wanting to suggest that it's going to be straightforward and easy sailing on the next election, but there was a bit of a trend.
So there were, Sarah Templeton tapped you. Were there other people particularly who encouraged you to go ahead?
Yeah, so Anne Brower, who was at the University of Canterbury, who I'd crossed paths with through doing my research, doing my dissertation and my work at the study at University of Canterbury. I actually can't remember who the others were. There was certainly another one, if not two. The thing that was in common, they were all women. It was all women who asked me if I would.
What did your election campaign look like? How did that go? Because people are really interested to know how an election campaign goes.
So I have just remembered who one of the other people was, and it was Jane Demeter, who was a regional councillor in the council that got essentially kicked out and replaced commissioners. And so she had run a campaign before and knew what to do, because I stood completely independently. I've never done anything like this before. Rather than being through something like People's Choice, which is an organised, you know, there's groups that organise candidates and help them with their campaign, and they know what they're doing. In my case, I had no idea what to do, but Jane Demeter had done campaigns before, having been elected as a council in the past. And so she sort of took me through the steps, and her tips obviously did come out good. So she suggested, the things I remember her suggesting were, have decent sized poster boards, you don't need loads, get them in good places, get a good photograph. And unfortunately, I think it's, if for women, that's a very, very much bigger deal than it is for men. I don't mean to be rude, but there are not all a pretty picture around my table. But I do think women struggle sometimes, and in fact, I even had an example of one of the constituents I bumped into as I was handing out leaflets, who said, I didn't like the look of her. I voted for the guy, voted for you, and I voted for the other guy, but I didn't like the look of the other woman. And it is the language I sort of was, and that I got comfortable to say that to me was surprising as well. And so my sense is that that does make a difference for women, yeah, more than it does for guys.
Because that's really interesting, because I think, you know, again, a lot of women probably find that really quite confronting, having to have a photo of themselves on a big poster and a billboard somewhere, let alone having that sort of reaction.
So I followed what I was advised, and felt quite. I didn't do door knocking. And I think environment Canterbury constituencies, we have four city council constituencies in our one. And so you're covering really big areas. So I've got like the Port Hills, Round the Bays, Spraydon, Cashmere, Summerfield, and then the whole of Banks Peninsula. So it's a really big area. They're practically across to Addington almost. And so, and there was only me, and I got young kids at the time. And so going door knocking, again, I wouldn't feel comfortable knocking on doors on my own either. But what I did was deliver a lot of leaflets, and I would talk to people as I went. I'd bump into people who were happy to chat. I'd explain who I was and what I was doing, and then have conversations. But in part, just trying to cover an area like that, and actually door knocking, realistically, how many doors can you knock on over that period? The constituency is about 63,000 people. So, yeah.
Do you think did you feel less comfortable as a woman door knocking, or just as your personality, you didn't really like doing it?
Probably both. Although that's so, like my family in the UK, my mum has always been really engaged in supporting campaigns in the UK. She's a Liberal Democrat. And so she's always supported the local MP and local councillors on those campaigns. So I've sort of seen it from a volunteer point of view. And she'd go door knocking. I know you want to be a bit cautious about dogs, for example. So, you know, certain things I've learned over from some of her experiences. But yeah, as a woman on my own, going to be knocking on doors, I don't feel comfortable doing that, but in part my personality as well. It's like, well, I think people hopefully can, from my leaflet I put in, you know, I put an email address on there, And so people could contact me if they had a question or something wanted to raise. I made sure my leaflet had some good information on that about what I stood for and what I was interested in. So I felt, well, actually, that's what I would... They're getting some information about me. They've got contact. They can get in touch with me. But to actually knock and disturb on the door and disturb somebody, I just feel like...
Do you know if some of the male candidates went door knocking?
The sort of political party groups... or the more politically organised groups, that's standard practice. They do that, and they don't. That's fine. I don't know if they knock on. Well, I don't know. I'm just suddenly thinking is whether they knock on every door, literally door to door to door to door to door, or whether they knock on people they know are, say, Labour supporters, and so you've already got an door in. You're not knocking on someone who's very politically dissimilar. Necessarily. So that might make it easier then, whereas I wouldn't have that intel. I wouldn't know who was going to vote what way typically. So I could, it'd be just potluck for me.
So you had the photo and then you had the leaflet. So you had to write, does everyone do a leaflet?
Yeah, that's pretty common practice. I made sure mine was on recycled paper and demonstrated that. I did black and white rather than often they're like, see in here. Is sort of bright, glossy, with a lot of ink, which, I'm sort of branding myself as interested in sustainability, and that doesn't sit, you can lessen your impact. My boards, actually, my poster boards were cardboard, so you can get them printed up onto cardboard. I taped the edges to make sure they didn't get as damaged through rain. They survived two, cardboard, but survived two campaigns. With the taped edges, they didn't expand and swell, but there was certainly plenty of rain. so they seemed to do quite well. And then they got into the recycling bin at the end, so they were after.
We looked at the other posters on You Can't Recycle.
Plastic, yeah, core flute, no. You can print it on the back. So if there are candidates who will turn them over and reuse them for a second campaign. But other than that, I don't know what happens after that, but yeah. So I guess that's the thing I did, is really try to think about what I stand for and then actually try to demonstrate it in the way I then approached my campaign.
So what else did you have to do for the campaign to get to you have to, and difficult for you on your own without having that support. So you have a leaflet that you drop on everybody's letterboxes around. That must have been massive doing that.
Yeah, I did. I was targeted. I couldn't do enough for the whole of all of their, but you sort of have a bit of a budget as well. And in fact, and I'm privileged that I could actually put a budget together to tackle this. So the notion that everybody's got agency to stand and we're all in equal pegging is flawed. That's totally flawed. But I think I did about 7,000 leaflets. I had an awesome guy who I met when I'd been doing tree planting. So I did a lot of tree planting over the years, and an elderly chap that was, he was keen to see me succeed. And so he delivered heaps. He'd been a surveyor in his career. So good, old fashioned surveying, tramping around all over the hills. And he turned 80 about 3 years ago. So it would have been, in his late 70s by the time he first helped me. And both campaigns, he's done the majority of all the Kashmir hills for jobs, which he wanted to do. So he'd been absolute stalwart. So I don't know if he might help me out again. But having someone like that was really lovely, having somebody who actually really believed in me, who wasn't just my husband.
And then, what else did you have to do for your campaign? Did you have to speak anywhere, or did you have to, go meet people? Or
so there's, you'll have the local media will get in touch and ask you to fill in information sometimes, so they'll put out information about the candidates, so that people can see through local media outlets who if the representatives are in the area that you can vote for. Old candidates are. There's also some of the local interest groups, like groups that are interested in like climate change action or youth voices or those sorts of groups they will send you, as what I know, Aotearoa Water Action in my first campaign, they sent out a questionnaire just to sort of specifically around your thinking around water issues. So you'll get some of that stuff that's more single issue or particular area of interest. And then you'll have the broader, sort of more generalised questions from, say, the media. And then there's various groups who organise candidate events as well. So typically there's been like a candidate event set up over at Mount Pleasant Community Centre, the Spraydon and the Summerfield Pleasant Associations will organise something. So, yeah, there's a few events get organised for candidates, meet candidates. Often environment candidates are sort of a bit lower down the pecking order of who people are really interested in, but we get a bit of time tacked in for the most part. And of course, we've got actually four constituencies, so you tend to end up, you've got four different events, at least one in each constituency area that is the city council one, which is nice as well because you get to meet the community board and the city council candidates and potential representatives. So you start to build some of those connections up and get to know who's who before you step in as a councillor as well through those events. So it's actually quite a useful way of getting to know people before you suddenly find yourself in the job.
How long does it go on for the campaign? How long do you have to be sort of focused on campaigning approximately?
Well, I've not really got stuck in until later. So I would be, your nomination has to go in sort of by some early July, early-ish in mid-July. I'd have done a bit of setting up for the boards and leaflets, knowing who I'm going to get printed with and things like that before then. And then I'm ready to roll more through into August and then into really September. I sort of focus in September more than anything because that's when the elections are in. Usually the final date for voting is around the 7th of October, something like that. So I know there are people who, you know, really care. And, you know, the mayors, city councillors, they tend to start earlier and have a much longer run, whereas I've tended to go more like when people are going to be getting their ballot papers and you've got the press and the like asking for information. I sort of, that's my core focus time is then. So it's partly reactive and partly proactive, and just having your paraphernalia ready to go is the main part. I'm currently thinking I need to go and get a haircut, and the photograph is my first step. And which colour am I going to wear? Because my first campaign, I just picked a dress I liked that was a bright colour, and I thought that would be good. And it's magenta pink, which has, of course, now got different connotations. So even if my boards were in pristine condition, I wouldn't be wearing them this year. And that's the active party for anyone who happened to listen to this in the future.
There's a lot to think about.
There is, I know.
What about writing the actual piece, you know, the blurb or persico, both on your flyer and on the voting papers or something?
Yeah, the nomination paper that you put in. Or nomination form. So, yeah, you have 150 words you have to craft. In my case, I think the thing that really won it for me the first time around was Master of Water Resource Management. And that 2019 election, the previous central government election was 2017. And it was water was a really hot topic in 2017. And I can remember because I was doing my master's then and I was thinking, wow, like I never imagined that water and the state of environment, water and environment would be such a hot topic in an election campaign coming from the UK, except that if you look at the UK right now, all of a sudden sewage in our rivers and poor water quality and all the rest of it is actually really a big issue. But back at that time, that seemed quite a surprise to me. But by 2019, at the local government, and of course Environment Canterbury is, you know, such a centre of competition for water, nitrate issues, all sorts of things. That was such a big ticket, Master of Water Source Management. People recognised that and they valued it. I think that's what really got me over the line, I think. And then subsequently I've become more, perhaps better moment for being particularly interested in public transport. It's not that I'm not interested in water, but water's a very big issue to change much and in any time soon. Whereas public transport, I've been able to make some actual change. So things like getting the tertiary student fares set up to reduce fares for tertiary students. My goal was under 25s, but I couldn't go over a line, so reframed it to tertiary students, and then subsequently did get under 25s. And I got the fare, top-up fare, you know, for topping up your Metro cards down from $10 down to $5, because I realised for some people, $10, and if you've got to do you, your two kids, like, it's adding up a lot to have to put down. And we had a submission from a lady who talked about the struggle to get her, someday she said she'd have to choose whether it was her child going to school or her going to work, because they wouldn't have enough to top up both cards. So I'm actually at $5 fare. So every time I see someone top up with just $5 at the front of the bus, I feel proud of that, even though it's something really small that no one else will probably think much of. I know a family's collection of these Metro cards that get you your cheapest fare to go and start fresh. It was that at one point it was $10 for your card, and then you had to put $10 top up, so that'd be $80. Then it dropped to $5 per card, and so it was $60. But to be able to front up and for a two-child family pay $60 up front to get a decent fare on that bus, it was really prohibitive. So I bring that sort of social conscience to environmental things that can have environmental benefits as well. So try and do.
What about, it sounds actually quite a lot of work for the campaign, I have to say, and also that you have to think about it really carefully. I think that's interesting to make sure that you make an impact.
Yeah.
So that people, you know, think about you.
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, I think I went on a tangent there. So the 150 words is not much to say much about. And so it's really finding those key hooks that you think the voter will be interested in and go, yeah, I can see where they're standing, why I'd like them as my rep. But in the second campaign, of course, you're trying to capture a bit of what you've achieved as well as who you are and what you're doing. So it always gets trickier. When you do the leaflets, of course, that's then for you to do. So you can put a bit more into the, well, you can put quite a lot more than just 150 words in. So that's why I felt like the leaflets were a particularly useful way of doing things. And if you just put them in as many of the letterboxes as you can, that's good information for people. Yeah.
What about your actual role? Can you sort of tell me about, you know, the requirements or the commitments of your role, what you actually have to do?
Yeah, well, a lot of reading. There is a lot of reading. The fundamentals of council is that you've got the organisation staff. We actually, as councillors, we only have one member of staff, which is the chief executive. And then they will be essentially the boss of the staff. But Environment Canterbury covers a wide range of things to do with all the natural resource management and then public transport services, so not the infrastructure, that's City Council. We're the services, the bus routes and the bus on there. And a lot of what council does really is it's about setting the direction and setting budgets and then tracking and getting the assurance that what you've sort of said we're going to do for our ratepayers is going to be delivered. And so there's a series of committees and council meetings essentially are providing that public facing information that we can debate, and when information comes to our table we can ask questions of the staff, and then we can have a debate where we've got staff asking us to make decisions, making recommendations, and so that's the sort of technicalities of what we do. And so the reports come through. We have at the moment a strategy and policy committee and a delivery committee, and then we have the whole of council. And we also have audit and risk committee, which is the first three I mentioned of all of the councillors, or all three of those, the two committees plus council. And then your audit and risk, and you've got regulation hearing committee. Those two have got a partial number of councillors on them. And all of those come with a chunk of reading. I've got quicker and better at reading them, and I understand now how the recommendations at the very front end are actually important. Coming from the sort of science background, I tend to dive into the reports and the detail and sort of not be aware so much of the significance of the recommendations. But now I've learned the craft of being a counsellor, actually the recommendations are really important. Of course, you need to read the report to understand why the recommendations are being put there and go, do I or don't I agree with that, which is ultimately what you're voting on. Or could I agree with that, but actually needs a bit of a change or a bit of a tweak. So that's a lot of what we do. I think a very good way of people, if people are interested in local government, is to look nowadays. There's a little live streams and recordings, so you can go online and see how these meetings run. And that would give you really good insight into what the job entails, that side of things. I also I try and make sure I stay connected with interest groups and organisations that are doing things that I have a particular interest in. So if people like, and there's an organisation we do as well, actually, but, you know, try and connect with people like Forest and Bird, but also we would connect with the irrigation sector and the farming, Federated Farmers and so on. But we, you know, try and make sure we're connecting across the board. And then I had a particular interest in connecting with academia as well. And so it just helps to sort of keep your sort of awareness of what's happening, what future thinking's happening, what's happening in some of the other local government sector, regional council. Oh, we have a lot come through from government, so our staff keep us abreast of a lot of that. But I read a lot of news, so I know I try and make sure I'm sort of covering the news as it comes through about things that government's looking at in terms of things like resource management changes or what's happening politically around water and wastewater, and, you know, try and sort of keep abreast of a lot of that stuff. So there's a lot of reading and quite a lot of talking, listening to people. Of course, then there's, it's good to get to some of the community, like residents associations and people like that. Regional council doesn't have the equivalent of community boards like the city council has. And so we don't quite have that same sort of connection into our local community as the city council and councillors have. It's just trying to make sure we keep abreast of all those different strands of information and knowledge and what people are thinking or what people need. It's quite a lot.
It does sound a bit.
Oh, and then there's a bit of a cycle. And so it also is not the same. Like, there's a lot of diversity every week, but within the sense that there's a bit of a regular pattern. So we'll have a council meeting each month and the various committees each month. Mm. So there's a bit of a base to the workload and the pattern. But then there's fluctuations in. So when you're coming up to annual plan, for example, you go through a consultation process leading into the annual plan deliberation. So there tends to be quite an extra workload at that point where you're hearing from submitters and reading submissions and getting your thoughts together and you're putting your ears out to figure out what to do for the budget time. There's a heap of work goes into all of that beforehand, but your consultation and the responses is informed to be across. So you suddenly will find you've got a great big chunk of extra work around particular parts of the sort of yearly, the year, there's a bit of seasonality to a counsellor's workload as well. And another bit actually we have is connecting with Māori Whanau. So we've got a Te Rorotoro Pātuia within Environment Canterbury, which has all been all about increasing our connection with Māori Whanau, understanding sort of what their needs and wants are and how we can work best together for the outcomes that we all want and working through that. That's not always straightforward. Sometimes there's some controversy and ultimately Etavio accounts as the 16 of us. And so, you know, you've got a diversity of thought, the thinking and diversity of opinions, and we all might have similar values at times, but different prioritise them or express them differently. So yeah, so that's a lot of it is that sort of the emotional intelligence side of things is quite important, I think, in a counsellor table. Yeah.
And given that there seems to be so much that you have to do, an awful lot of time, how do you juggle this alongside any other commitments you have? How do you juggle being an environment counsellor with, well, you know, family and any other commitments that you have?
With now my kids are older, so it's got a lot easier. When they were younger, that was could be tricky. I do remember the first time, my husband fabulous and he's been a real supporter, but I do remember the first time when we had one of our children was sick and I had to go, I actually have to be in the council. I can't remember what we'd do, something like maybe an important workshop or something like that, where I knew that I needed to be in person in there. And it was the first time that my husband had had to be the one to take the day off to look after this or work from home, to look after a sick child. Whereas in the past, many years, it would always have been me that would have juggled things and been the one to step in. Like he would probably deny this, but I definitely sort of sense his like little moment of what do you mean? And in some ways, sometimes I think, you know, our society is kinder to allow, like, more tolerant of women being the primary caregiver and taking that decision, going, I need to be home to look after the sick child. I don't think we always are as respectful of men doing that, taking that. You know, other men might not be quite so, you know, recognise that that's actually perfectly reasonable. That's sort of my sense. It might be that younger guys are now a bit, I think things have evolved over the decades and we're definitely moving into a much better position now, but I don't think men are always given the same fair go of saying actually I want to be a part-time worker. I think it's an assumptions made about their commitment to their job or their level of ambition or whatever when they make those calls. So we need to, there's a few things in society we need to change for men as well as for women if we're going to actually see true equality.
So it has been a bit of a joyful at times, but this is, you're going for your third term, is that right?
Yep, I have said I will stand again.
Yeah. So you've managed to make it work.
Yeah.
Nicely.
Environment Canterbury is supposed to be a part-time role, so we don't get paid at the same level as City Council. Because we are part-time, the role is expected to be managed within a part-time, in a part-time way. And to be fair, there are times where I've ended up reading late into the night and what have you, but I can juggle things around and I've been able to, you know, get my kids to like an after-school sport thing or, you know, I can, generally speaking, there's like 2 days a week where I'm in the office and I have to be in council. But I've got flexibility around the other days. So it's not been a bad job in that sense to juggle. Okay.
What about, just wondering, has the reality of the role been quite what you'd expect it before you took this on? You know, if you can perhaps think back to your first term, was it what you expected it was going to be?
I honestly don't think I really had any expectations, if I'm honest. That is I wasn't really expecting to get in anyway, but and it was at a particular point in time where I had I didn't have a job to go to. For me, I knew it was going to be a challenge because I am quite an introvert. Like, I felt really anxious when I finally went, I'll put my hand up. And in part also, it was going to be a personal challenge. And I thought, well, that's a learning experience. That's not a bad thing to do. But I can remember, you know, standing and shaking as I was reading off a piece of paper and I felt really, it wasn't a comfortable place to be. So I didn't really think too hard about what the job would be. What I do remember is when I stepped in, because I also, like I said, I worked in sort of geology, hydrogeology, contaminated land, engineering, technical side of things back in the UK. And then I stepped across and did planning work for minerals and waste, sort of strategic planning. which covers quite a breadth of the sort of work that Environment Canterbury does. So I got a good sort of technical understanding and background. And I thought that that was going to be really useful in this job. And it is, but it's not really my technical background or any of that that's really what the job's about. The job's about, it's like it's actually really political. So do you remember as I stepped in, all of a sudden there was a whole lot of conversation, who's going to be the chair, working out who, what, you know, where are the alliances in the groups that have been, in the people who've been elected, like how is this all going to play out? And all of a sudden I was into this political world, which I thought was going to be more, I don't know, I just thought, you know, oh, I've got skills to bring from my technical background. But then it was all political, which was luckily that was fine. Like, you know, I've adapted to that and that's fine.
But it was quite surprising for you that it was.
Yeah, and also, see, I'd not done any sort of governance role. And that's the other thing. I would sort of have people saying, oh, you know, got it, this is governance. You need to stay in your lane, stay in governance, not cross into, don't get, dig into the detail. I think there's a degree of trying to undermine that. I definitely felt there was a little bit of trying to undermine what I could bring to the table. It very much felt like, if you haven't run a multi-million dollar dairy farm, what are you doing here? Like, you know, if you haven't got some Institute of Directors qualifications, you don't really know what you're doing. Which is really, I don't think, is that a, you know, council is completely different from a business. And so whilst I know that there's some overlap in some of those skills, actually for me, a council table, well, another factor things net is really proven that having a diverse range of directors in a company means you, if we group think, and there's a really important role in having people with different perspectives and experiences coming to there. At a council table, especially because we are representing a very broad group of people and we are having to think about the four well-beings. We're not beholden like a company director might be to ultimately your single priority is profit and economics. We have to really look at the four well-beings. So yeah, it took me a little bit of a, oh, I wasn't expecting to be undermined. I thought we'd all be coming in as equals here and then working together. And suddenly it felt like there was a bit of jostling and a bit of, you know, chest beating and all that stuff.
Was it with you being an independent too? Like you weren't aligned to any of those other?
Potentially it could have been, although I'd, like I said, made some connections through the campaign time several years, but a bit naive. I hadn't really appreciated what a council at the council table was like. I'd worked in a council, so I'd got a sense of councils and what councils do. Some of my work with that was around, in planning, was about getting stakeholder engagement and all that sort of thing. So that for me has always been something really important. It felt quite interesting that all of a sudden it was as if it was trying to make out like we weren't all equal. But I think it's a bit, I mean, there's some egos that come around the table.
Even though it was a democratic process.
Even though it's a democratic process, in the theory, we're all elected there on an equal level. Yes.
What, can you think of some of the high points of your time so far in your role?
Well, particularly getting things over the line. So, yeah, the dry, really pushing for a, like I said, I wanted to get over to under 25s as a bus fare in order, partly to, because I knew to, there's a reasonable amount of that cohort who struggle financially, but also because I felt that's where our opportunity is to increase passenger numbers. Getting the tertiary student fare, that was a real shift at the time that wasn't being done. And there was a lot of pushback on the notion that if you reduce the fares, you'll get more passengers. The focus was all on more frequency, more reliability, that's where you'll win more passengers. But I felt like, well, trouble is we can't put more money in to achieve those things if the argument is nobody's on bus. So you've got to break something somewhere to, you know, you get a shift. And that's played out. We've totally just got loads more people coming in since we reduced the fares. And of course, the Labour government also then supported and put in like free for children 13 and under, I think it was, and they put in the subsidising under 25s through Wheaton Councils as well. So those things all came in. The $5 fare, like I said. Trying to think of some other... Around water, that's probably been more disappointing. I haven't really managed to make much progress on water and changing the state of playing in the water environment. But you can see through some of the sort of language that gets used in some of our work now, and like we have a draft region policy statement that's now looking at catchments, and we're talking about catchments rather than by looking at districts. Mm. So from a water point of view, catchments are far more logical way of thinking. And so some of the narratives that many of us around the table talk to, you're starting to see these things pull through. And we'll see where that goes. The current government's not been quite so helpful.
What's been challenging there, and you know, in terms of perhaps trying to get things over the line, but also maybe in, I don't know, any relationships or conflict situations or working with the public or whatever, is there anything that you found particularly challenging?
The thing that I find more challenging is when I know that there are really passionate community members and people really wanting to see change. So like the state of our aquifers or water flows and sorting out over allocation issues and things like that. And the bit that I find hardest is when I have people who are passionate about that stuff, which I am too, challenging me that I haven't, you know, we haven't managed to get things to change. And it's really hard realize it. You know, you have to realize you're only one out of a table of 16. And even in if you've got a majority, it's easier. But we've, in both council terms I've been on, we've been really close to being broadly 8-8 on the more sort of the issues that where you can take quite a different position. Mm. So on the environmental stuff, I mean, broadly everybody, whatever, regardless of your politics, everybody's wanting to see, knows that change needs to happen, knows that we need to do more for the environment, knows we need to do more for our water. Mm-hmm. And it really comes down to the pace of change, because the pace of change is what it essentially is costing businesses. And it depending on how you look at it and who's picking up the costs. And so that's been a challenge, is just being how to make progress when you don't have a clear majority. And the sort of frustration. So, for example, the draft Legion of Policy Statement that we had staff working on budgets, or, you know, we'd had budgets, we got deadlines. And then at the 11th hour, the government changed a policy around, they basically said, we're stopping new freshwater plans at this point in time for another year until we relook at the National Policy Statement for Freshwater. Arguably, we could have got that over the line to be notified, our regional policy statement, because it's not a freshwater plan. It's a regional policy statement that has a bit in it about freshwater. It's the bit that there are those around our table particularly very interested in that. You know, the farming sector have been making noise saying they weren't happy with the fact that this region policy statement was going to, you know, essentially is going, yeah, it's driving towards change and improvements. And would have kept us going on that trajectory, and instead it's got parked. And it's those sorts of things that are really frustrating.
Yeah.
And we could have pushed the issue, but because we were so closely on the line, we could have made that argument that it was ambiguous whether it was a freshwater plan. So we're going to test it and we're going to notify it, and then we'll see what the government does. So we could have gone down that line, which is where I wanted to tend to, and where I voted. But others didn't vote that way. There were enough around the table, didn't want it to go anyway. And then there was an easy argument to say, oh, but the government will just cost us more if we do that. But there's a cost to sitting and parking it as well. Mm. So those are the sorts of things that are frustrating when it's those really important things that we've been driving along, that I know I'm hearing people really wanted to see change, and the politics can just stop things dead. That's really tough to take. Particularly, I mean, that was something that really a number of us had come back into this term specifically to see that through. Mm-hmm. And then it's just us stuck.
And that's it. Need another turn to see it through.
Yeah, yeah, maybe.
What about in terms of support, you know, that you need to fulfill your role? What sort of support do you feel you need for you to be able to do this role?
Well, say it right, my husband's been just a sort of emotional support. And I've really found, I mean, this term, I've found in both my terms, the women around my around the table have been really supportive as well. Like, we support each other, and also, like, some of the councillors at City Council, like, as women, you do come together a bit and try to just meet up for coffee on a semi-regular basis and things like that. And it's just, as much as anything, it's just a bit of mental health and conversation with people who understand the job. Our council table this time around, there's 3 women and 13 men. So it's become much, much more, there's a lot more testosterone around the table this year, this time around, than the last time. We had a female chair last time, Jenny Huey, who's an absolute stalwart and totally knew her stuff and, you know, staunch feminist from the 70s and so much to admire. And she really sort of led us really smartly, and she knew what she wanted to achieve. And that was just, it was a great first term to have that. And I think had I come in this term to the current table, I don't know if I'd be standing for a second term, because it's definitely just felt different. It's been less collegiate in a way. And I think that is in part down to the fact that we've gone from, and we had 50% women last time. And across the political spectrum, like, you know, it's on across the political spectrum, but it's just different ambience when you've got more women, in my experience.
So how do we encourage other women to stand? What do you think, from a gender equality perspective, can you sort of say what you think women bring to councils or boards?
Yes, well, I think we totally bring a different experience. So for me, for example, I'm on the Greater Christchurch Partnership, and I will talk about the fact that women experience urban environments differently to men, and that we need to think about that and to look for understanding the differences of how we experience things for our staff to then bring into their planning and thinking. I'm still on that journey, trying to get that taken on board. I haven't succeeded on that yet. And I mean, I've sort of travelled around, used the bus system a lot with my young kids as a commuter, but who needed to get back to kindy bang on time. So, you know, you'd hear. So I remember early days, one of a councillor at City Council, I think, who was talking about the bus lanes. And he's like, oh, of course, it's really important to get the bus lane so that they get you into the office on time. You know, going in one way, if you're going to prioritise the ones that go in, because that's really important, and not prioritising the ones that get you back out. I'm like, you've not sat on a bus watching the time ticking away because you're stuck in traffic, and you got on this bus expecting to be at kindy on time, and now you're not, and you're desperately trying to ring friends who are on their journey to get to kindy and not picking up their phones, to saying, can you please pick up my child so that I'm not going to get, you know, have a traumatized child or a big fine. So, you know, so it's that sort of thing you can bring. And I think that just maybe women have got a different, just our emotional intelligence, perhaps, in some times. I might be generalising, probably generalising now, but I think there's something in the fact that, you know, we're naturally the sort of nurturers and carers, and so perhaps more inclined to actually really think about how does this decision really impact on people, and particularly those who are more vulnerable. And listen to the people that come and talk to our table and take what they're telling us on board.
So how important is it, do you think, for women to actually put themselves forward to stand? How's it important to have women on local body government?
Yeah, if women don't stand, you're not in, and the table stays imbalanced. And I think the problem as well is, like I'm experienced, like I've experienced this term, the problem is you get into a declining spiral. So it's tougher for women in a minority. And so then you don't stand again. Mm-hmm. And so then it becomes a smaller number again, and it goes into a downward spiral. So I think we really need women to stand so that you hopefully, you can build up the numbers, and then it becomes a group, a council becomes a group that better represents the full society. We've got, we are 50% of the population. So to have currently less than 20% of women at our table is, that's not representative. I get the age thing. What worries me is that when you look at some of the stats around candidates standing in the last election that I saw, it was split by age groups or by gender. And the proportion of women standing was still like 2 men to 1 woman, even in the youngest age category of like 18 to 25. So there won't be a change in the gender representation unless we make it change. There's a lot of focus on youth voice and younger voices, and that's not being reflected in the council table, but the gender stuff's not going to solve itself. It's not going to just happen. We've been pushing this now for 130 years here, and we have not solved it yet. So we've just got to, and it's a really interesting, really rewarding job. There's lots of positive to say about it. The part-time councils where you can have do the work part-time can work in with having kids. Yes, it's really interesting. You get a reward of doing something positive for your community, even though there are times where it's tough.
What about some of, just sort of last thing, we just want to know, what about some of the things that women might need in a skill set, in their skill set, sort of what are the, there's the practical details that you might be aware of before entering Melville government, and then there might be some of the things that, particularly rated being a woman, that they should be aware of. I mean, you've touched on some of these as you've been talking anyway. But what sort of a skill set do you think women might need if they're going to put themselves forward?
Well, I almost could flip it and say the things you don't need. So I was an introvert. I could feel my heart rate go up when I was going to ask a question at the table. I shook my way through all of the candidate events in the first round of term. But I felt confident that I got something to offer. In this particular case, I got clear work experience that touched into the areas of environment Canterbury. So I felt like I could bring some knowledge to those things. A strong belief that women's voices should be heard and need to be there. And so it was a challenge for me personally to stand that first time, but I've learned it. And now I can talk to a group off the cuff and not have my heart rate go up. So you can learn it. It's not a skill you have to have. You learn it. I think there's a lot of, if you're just thinking about crafting a speech or, how to pitch something, there's podcasts and bits, YouTube videos we can pick up on and figure out what things you might need to work on. Really useful to put, if you're putting like your 150 words together or putting a speech together for that first campaign, put by people you trust what you're putting out, what suggesting, ask for some people just to put some time and thought to what you're suggesting. It's all doable. And you just got to just have a go, I think. That would be my main.
Well, hopefully women will. And just the last thing, and you sort of thought, for yourself or for women in particular, about the transition back into sort of the workforce or the whatever, once you perhaps finish your role? How do you think the transition, how easy do you think the transition might be once you perhaps finish your role?
That's something that I know can be tricky for people. I've definitely heard that said. I probably depends on what your previous career and background is, how easy it is and what your network is. Being part-time, there's courses, you know, you can take courses part-time whilst you're a counsellor as well. So sort of that was probably smart to have a bit of an eye to that later, but I think you probably have to ask me in either 6 months' time if I don't get back in, or in 3 years' time if I do.
Oh, good. And Ida, we're very lucky that you're standing again, because it is, I mean, it's a service to the community. And, you know, from National Council of Women's perspective, it's just fantastic that there are women like you who will stand and stand again and again. So we're very thankful. So thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for listening to Don't Leave It All to the Men. Our next episode will feature Marie Palisco talking about her experiences as a member and current chair of the Waipuna Hallswell Hornby Riccarton Community Board. The National Council of Women's vision is for a gender-equal New Zealand. Find out more about what they get up to and how you can get involved by heading to www.ncwnz.org.nz, emailing ncwnzchch@gmail.com, or find them on Facebook and Instagram. You can find this episode on the Plains Media website, plains.org.nz. Until next time, mā te wā.